Hello. My name is Leslie. Welcome to our podcast featuring excerpts from Dr. Ed's morning briefing, which is produced by our team at Yordani Research. Today's commentary is dated Tuesday, February 18, 2020. The first topic focuses on the PE-led rally in the stock market. You have to be really in love with stocks to buy them when the forward PE of the S&P 500 is trading at 18.9. with the stock index 11.2% above its 200-day moving average. But lots of amorous investors did just that on Valentine's Day at the end of last week. Love conquers all, even fears of the coronavirus. On February 3, Joe and I added the coronavirus outbreak as panic attack number 66 on our list with a January 24 date, when the outbreak news first hit the tape. So far, it has turned out to be among the very short and minor sell-offs, as the S&P 500 dropped only 3.0% from January 23 through January 31. Since then, the index has staged an impressive relief rally with a gain of 4.8%, closing at a new record high of 3,380.16 on Friday. A gain of just 3.5% would put it at our 3,500 target for year-end. The S&P 500 is up 4.6% year-to-date. Technically, the S&P 500 has been vulnerable to a correction. But the latest panic attack didn't last long enough to give investors much of an opportunity to buy stocks at lower prices. Most of the buying has focused on the 100 largest capitalization stocks within the large cap universe, which we've dubbed the super caps. That's been a trend for a while, but one that has accelerated so far this year. Consider the following. Point number one. The ratio of the equal-weighted to the market cap-weighted S&P 500 indexes is down from 1.57 at the start of 2017 to 1.42 on Friday, its lowest ratio since December 2009. Over the period, the former is up 34.5%, while the latter is up 48.8%. Point number two. The ratio of the S&P 500, large caps, to the S&P 100, super caps, had been fluctuating around 2.26 since the start of 2017. It was at a 7-year low on Friday, having edged down to 2.23 from 2.24 at the end of last year, as the former rose 4.6%, while the latter rose 5.1%. Point number three. The forward PE of the S&P 500 is higher than the ones for the S&P 400/600s. Indeed, the former rose to 18.9 on February 14, the highest reading during the current bull market, while the S&P 400/600s forward PEs, at 17.3 and 17.4, remain below their 2017 cyclical peaks. Point number four. Megacaps are boosting the S&P 500 valuation multiple. In last Wednesday's morning briefing, we reported that the stocks we collectively call the megacaps, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, and Microsoft, nearly doubled their combined market capitalization since late 2018 to $5.7 trillion currently, accounting for a record 20% of the total market cap of the S&P 500. Their collective forward PE is around 35, up 52% since late 2018. As a result, the forward PE of the S&P 500 is about 19 with them and 17 without them. In other words, the megacaps are currently adding a record 2 percentage points to the S&P 500 forward PE. Point number 5. Upturns in forward revenues and earnings growth rates remain lackluster and vulnerable. Historically low inflation and interest rates help to justify high forward PEs. Joe and I would be more in love with stocks and show that by raising our 3,500 year-end target for the S&P 500 if we saw better growth in S&P 500 forward revenues and earnings. That seems to have started to happen during the February 6 week, when the former was up 5.0% year-over-year, and the latter was up 4.1% year-over-year. Both represent possibly bottom-forming rebounds from recent lows. However, industry analysts may have only just started to chop their earnings estimates for Q1-Q3 this year, in response to the negative impact of the coronavirus on global economic growth. The second topic focuses on the liquidity diet provided by the major central banks. The question is whether PEs can hold up at currently elevated levels if earnings growth doesn't make a meaningful comeback this year from last year's earnings growth recession. Joe and I doubt it. However, the downside may be limited by the major central bank's ongoing provision of ultra-easy monetary policies. Consider the following recent developments. Point number one. The Fed. Whether it's called reserve management, RM, or quantitative easing QE, the Fed's assets have increased $423 billion since the August 28, 2019 week through the February 12 week to $4.1 trillion. Over the same period, the Fed's portfolio of U.S. Treasury securities increased $347 billion, while its holdings of agency debt and mortgage-backed securities declined $108 billion. While this increase was justified by Fed officials as necessary to settle down the unsettled repo market, investors obviously have welcomed the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet once again. Since the Fed started its RM program on November 1, 2019, the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond yield has declined 14 basis points to 1.59% on Friday, while the S&P 500 has risen 10.2%. Point number two. The ECB. The balance sheet of the European Central Bank, ECB, has remained relatively flat around 4.7 trillion euros ever since it terminated its asset purchase program on December 31, 2018. On the other hand, the ECB did restart this program on November 1, 2019, committing to purchase 20 billion euros every month in securities. Sure enough, securities held for monetary policy purposes rose 53 billion euros since late last year through the February 7 week. Point number three. The BOJ. Meanwhile, the Bank of Japan BOJ never terminated its QE program, which started on April 4, 2013. Since then through January of this year, the BOJ's balance sheet has increased 231%, mostly as a result of purchasing government bonds. Point number four. The PBOC. On Monday, China's Shanghai Composite rose 2.3%, while the Shenzhen Composite jumped 3.2%. The People's Bank of China, PBOC, cut the reserve requirement ratio for large banks and small banks by 100 basis points to 12.5% and 10.5% during January. It is expected to step up its liquidity measures, easing funding conditions in Chinese money markets, to combat the downside risks posed by the viral infection. In addition, CNBC reported on Monday, quote, China is planning targeted tax cuts while increasing government spending, Finance Minister Liu Kun wrote Sunday in China's Communist Party magazine Kyushu. The Ministry of Finance said Saturday it would provide 8 billion yuan in a second round of support for virus prevention and control efforts. As of Friday, all levels of finance ministries in China had allocated 90.15 billion yuan in support, according to the central government, unquote. The third topic focuses on the slow and steady growth in GDP. The U.S. economic outlook remains a nab-nab, i.e., neither a boom nor a bust. It's the perfect scenario for keeping a lid on inflation and prolonging the current economic expansion. However, recent retail sales data have been weaker than expected, especially given the strength of employment. Is there something holding back consumer spending? We don't believe so. But before we have a closer look at consumers, let's take a look at the latest GDP now, which is compiled by the Atlanta Fed. Reflecting the weakness in retail sales, Friday's estimate showed real GDP growing 2.4% during Q1, down from the February 7 estimate of 2.7%. That's consistent with the economy's performance since 2010. That would actually be a solid reading for Q1, which has had a tendency to be the weakest quarter for growth since 2010. The fourth topic focuses on consumer spending. So what's going down with retail sales? On a three-month average basis, inflation-adjusted retail sales excluding building materials, using the CPI for goods, has been flat for the past 5 months through January. This series closely tracks real personal consumption outlays on goods. Now consider the following related developments. Point number one. Weak spending at GAFO retailers. Even in current dollars, many categories of retail sales in January's Census Bureau release are actually down on a year-over-year basis as follows. Department stores, -3.9%, electronics and appliance stores, -2.9%, health and personal stores, -1.9%, sporting goods, hobby, musical instrument and book stores, -1.5%, building material and garden equipment and supplies dealers, -1.4%, and clothing and clothing accessories stores, -0.7%. Most of these stores are included in GAFO, which stands for General Merchandise, Apparel and Accessories, Furniture and Furnishings, and Other. They all are facing tremendous competition from online merchants. Point number 2. Strong online spending. The latest available data showed that online shopping accounted for 35.0% of online plus GAFO sales during December. GAFO sales is up just 1.6% year-over-year through December, while online sales is up 20.2%. Point number 3. Saving more. Debbie and I suspect the consumers may simply be stuffed with stuff. They are spending more on services and also saving more. Aging baby boomers are spending more on healthcare and leisure activities, while millennials are spending more on education and experiences. As for saving, they are all more frugal for various reasons. The percentage of singles in the civilian non-institutional working age population, i.e., 16 years and older, was 50.5% in January, little changed from November's record high of 51.0%, as young people have been postponing marriage, and seniors have been living longer, increasing the population of widowers and divorced people. Singles may have a higher propensity to save, including by paying off debts, and a lower propensity to spend, especially on stuff. Whatever the reason, personal saving totaled a record $1.3 trillion last year, up from $1.2 trillion during 2018, and $1.0 trillion during 2017. Point number 4, NAB. We conclude that there is neither a boom nor a bust in the consumer sector. That's all for now. Thanks for listening today. Please see the hedge clause on our website www.yourdanny.com. Please let Dr. Ed know if I am doing a better job for you than Siri or Alexa. Goodbye.